Wrestling Federation can keep signing Stone Cold Steve Austin to matches. And as long as they keep signing me to the likes of people like Sonny Rogers, I'm not going to wrestle, son. What the whole world is looking at is the King of the Ring.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Following Wrestling Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Welcome to episode 154 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And today, going to be taking a look at some 1996 WWF. And I've discovered something about myself in researching for this show. I'll get into that in a second. It's WWF Superstars from July 20th of 96. You probably wonder, why would you pick a Superstars? Wasn't Raw the top show at that point? Indeed it was. But Superstars still had a few things going on, such as a guy that you're going to see that's on the rise on this particular show. We also have a name match on the program, which always helps and is kind of random because it's not during sweeps or anything. But in doing the research for this show, I've watched the Raw a couple of weeks before. I watched the pay-per-view that aired the following day, In Your House International Incident, and I liked pretty much all of it. It was really kind of fun. Usually, summer of 96, you associate that much more with WCW in terms of, well, that stuff is more must-see. But for whatever reason, I really dug this. And anyway, before I get into all that, why don't I get in my plugs? You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. And if you've noticed over the past few days, I've started, because February is, this is the third year anniversary of this program, which I started in February of 2017. And on SoundCloud, there's a little show image that you upload with it. You don't really have to do it. It could just default back to the Greetings from Allentown logo that I do want to change into something else, but whatever it is, I don't know yet. I really don't know what I want to do with it. But the image, I try to take a screenshot from the show in question, which is fairly common among other podcasts that I've seen. I know Between the Sheets has done that for a very long time, or at least when they were on SoundCloud. Actually, I'm not sure if they still are, but I know that they did that when that show started out on the SoundCloud platform. So I've been taking those show images and just kind of explaining what they are, and I'm going to run through this really long thread. Now, as I tape this, it is Super Bowl Sunday, and I've only posted the first four episodes. But I'm going to be doing more as the week goes along because it kind of gives me something easy to tweet. And I've saved all of those damn screenshots for the last 2 years, so I might as well do something with it at some point. Oh, yes, and you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, and I urge you to check out all the other great programs on this feed. Hit that subscribe button on iTunes, Apple Music, or whatever your podcatcher is, because you can download this program twice. That'd really make me feel good, because then on the download metrics, it'll actually show one on one thing and then one on the other thing, although honestly, I only ever really see the one that's on my own feed, but like I said a couple weeks ago, I'm not too hung up on any of that. It doesn't really make a difference to me. I just enjoy doing this on a weekly basis over the last 3 years, because it's a distraction from certain things that happen in life that are real annoyances. I mean, I have a lot to be thankful for right now after all the various health foibles that I've had in the last 2 months with gallbladder and knee. Today's the first day that I've been walking around without a knee brace in over a month. Every day when I would get dressed, I felt like Smash from Demolition, who always had that huge knee brace on his leg, like right above his boot. But anyway, I'm glad for all that, but people don't want to hear me talk about how I've lost, you know, 15 or 20 pounds just from not drinking, because that's not interesting. You don't hear about stuff like that. You want to hear about customer service complaints, because I'm not going to throw this organization under the bus, but I've been a Hyundai owner for the last 17 years. And obviously, you know, I like the cars well enough. I mean, there's a lot of other good cars out there that I would be interested in purchasing. But, you know, I took my car in for a service that 120,000 miles. You'd say, well, why don't you just get a new car at this point? Well, no, I want to keep that car for a little while longer, in part because it's a hybrid and I really like the gas mileage that I get with it, considering that I drive 33 miles each way to work, sometimes even more than that if I have to take an alternate route. So I take it in, and I knew I might have to get other stuff done. The brakes are a little squishy, so I ended up getting that done too, because I was getting 10 or 15% off the whole order because of a coupon that they sent. I'm like, okay. Well, as I'm there, I use the opportunity of being in a car dealership for several hours at a time, because I generally like to go early morning so that they can bring the car right in, get it done, get it over with. I don't have to worry about, oh, my wife has to pick me up at the thing or however. I'm not bothering anybody else. And I use this time to watch wrestling on my phone. Of course, they have an annoying type of Wi-Fi where you can't watch YouTube videos, so I had to go off data anyway. But it's data well spent when you're watching July 1996 WWF, or at least it is to me, because I really, really like it. So I'm there for a good three and a half hours, because, you know, there's a lot of things that you need to do. There's the transmission fluid exchange thing, and they were doing spark plugs, lot of different things. So I get my car back, finally, at about 11:10, something like that. I brought it in about 7:40 in the morning. I get in the car, and it starts vibrating very weirdly under my seat. And not in the way where, like, it was Betty Draper in Mad Men who sat on the washing machine so she could get herself off. Yeah, that's not going to do a whole lot for me. So I had to get out of the car, and I go back in. I'm like, my check engine light just came on. I'm getting this weird vibration. They're like, oh, yeah, there's a certain induction underneath where it's going to blow all the stuff out of there, but I'll have them take a look at it, and, you know, we'll do that. So now I'm stuck for another 45 minutes there. And my phone, because it's a couple of years old, I was wearing down the battery pretty fast. That's what happens when you're watching hot 1996 WWF action. Like, the battery was down to like 30%, and it was at 100 when I got there. That's how much video I was watching while I was there. I should probably check my data and just make sure that I didn't go through too much. So I'm waiting there. I could have walked somewhere for lunch, but at that point, it's like, well, they could bring it back any second. But they bring it back about 50 minutes after. I'm like, okay, fine. They did whatever. They blew everything out. Okay. It's very annoying that they held me there for a little bit longer, but it's done. I can put this behind me. I get in the car. I drive home, and I'm on my merry way. But then later, I decide to go out and have a coffee with my wife, and on the way home from there, the damn check engine light comes on again, and I am pissed because I spent a damn lot of money in that place, and they had to take it back in, hold me there for almost another hour, and now I've got to go back there again after calling them because it's getting very close to when service is going to close. So effectively, they're like, yeah, bring it in. We'll look at it, and we'll give you a loaner for a couple of days. So I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. This is like the first time I've driven a non-hybrid in quite some time that wasn't a, I guess I've done, you know, rental cars, but I'm now driving a 2020 Hyundai Tucson, which is an okay car, but lacks a certain giddy-up, and that's my concern. It's why I would never actually buy one of them. There's no satellite radio in there, which is also kind of annoying, and it doesn't have that auto park thing for like the commercial on the Super Bowl that aired, I guess. I'm projecting because I'm recording this before the Super Bowl, but there's this ad with all the less annoying Boston celebrities that they chose for that. John Krasinski, one of the guys named Chris, I'm not sure which one that is, and Rachel Dratch, who I'm convinced they got because Amy Poehler's quote was too high. So they're like, all right, we'll get the other lady who's from the Boston area that was on SNL. It doesn't have that auto park feature, and besides, I know how to park my damn car, okay? So by the time I'm done recording this, theoretically, I'll have my car back, but I will be an unhappy camper about it because, well, the whole thing has kind of cost me a lot of money. They did give me a free oil change next time, which I, oh boy, I can't wait to bring my car back here. But I think the lesson is, next time, try to schedule it for more like lunchtime, because there's a really good restaurant across the street called La Carreta, Southern New Hampshire's premier Mexican restaurant. I know you're just dying for reviews about that. Actually, the best Mexican restaurant in New Hampshire is El Rincon up in Manchester, across from whatever the hell they call the arena now, that sometimes has WWE events. And hey, that's a nice little tie-in to bring it back to whatever the hell it is that I talk about on this podcast. So I watched this show at the dealership, and you're wondering, why are you doing a show from 96? I've done these before. I did a Mania from March of 96. I did the Pillman one from October of 96. So this will only be, I think, the third 96 WWF show. I gotta switch it up every so often. There was one review left on iTunes for this program. 5 stars, and thank you very much for that, by the way. And to anybody else who has done that in the past, or is doing that in the future, or is doing that actually right now in the present as I'm speaking into your ears. They say, I love the way that you jump around the various decades. I gotta keep things interesting. I like to go back, you know, and watch stuff that, like, oh yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed watching this when it came on the WWE Network originally. Like, when I subscribed to the network in 2014, I started watching Raws from 96 because 95 always has this stigma to it for whatever reason. It's not as bad as people remember. And 96 is interesting to me because everybody thinks WCW first because Nitro was red hot. And here's the WWF kind of lagging behind in that. Number one, it's a one-hour program, which I adore and love that they stayed at an hour until the early spring of 1997, I think it was, just before WrestleMania 13, I think it was, when they made the switch. So I guess it might have been the winter. Taping Raw 4 weeks at a time, which seems insane when they were going up against a live program. But I think part of it was that they just decided that the cost savings from it was worth more than anything they might gain from going live on a more frequent basis. Also, you got to deal with the USA Network and perhaps get their sign-off. So I really wanted to do this show because there's a couple of things on this, such as Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Goon and Hunter Hearst Helmsley, that I definitely want to cover. But I would be remiss if I didn't talk a little bit about WCW, the July of 1996. I talk about, oh, everybody thinks about what's happening over there, because Hulk Hogan's turning heel at Bash of the Beach earlier that month. We're 2 weeks removed from that as this show airs. And yeah, that's very interesting. Yes, that set their business on fire, the NWO. That's all really great. But right here is the Stone Cold Steve Austin incubation period. And I don't want to sound sacrilegious when I say this. I say this as kind of a more informational thing, maybe something I said as a wisecracking teen in high school, going to Catholic high school. But in doctrine, Jesus was crucified on what is now known as Good Friday. And on the third day, Easter Sunday, he rose again in fulfillment of the scriptures. So my question always was, what did Jesus do on Saturday? Like, what was going on there? What did he do Saturday morning when he got up? And that's with, like, Steve Austin. He wins the King of the Ring, and then you kind of flash forward to the Bret Hart feud, Survivor Series, WrestleMania, those matches. Except what happens in between with Austin is kind of interesting to me. And a long time ago, and if you listen to the early episodes, I occasionally plug my blog, section309.com. I wrote an article on Stone Cold Steve Austin for the year 1996, starting out as the Ringmaster, becoming Stone Cold just before WrestleMania 12. This weird period between the King of the Ring and when Bret Hart is about to show up again in September and October leading up to the Survivor Series. They're doing some very interesting things with Austin to kind of build him slowly. I'd almost argue maybe too slowly, given he's not even on the SummerSlam main card, which just seems insane considering what he becomes 6 months to a year later. But he's not the only thing that's trending in the correct direction on this show. We got Vader, who is part of Camp Cornette. They're in the main event at In Your House, International Incident, which, yes, it is internet. Even though it's Vancouver, it is still an international incident. Vader being used properly for about a month, month and a half, 2 months or so in the WWF as this monster on the wall. And you don't think of any time in his WWF career where that occurred. But sure enough, for the month of July, Vader was going pretty damn strong. Now, I'd mentioned that pay-per-view, the In Your House International Incident. It's my second favorite event that has ever taken place in that arena in Vancouver. Of course, behind Game 7 of the 2011 Stanley Cup Final. It was also the site of December 1998 pay-per-view In Your House Rock Bottom. Not sure if it had the In Your House moniker, but it's a International Incident is a very underappreciated show, I think. It lives in the shadow, I think, of Bash at the Beach, because it's the same month and something very, very famous happened. But the In Your House shows in general, I seem to like them all because they really fly by. As somebody who really adores one-hour weekly television shows, I also adore these very quick pay-per-views that are maybe 5-6 matches that are just a very, very easy watch. As for the Superstars tapings, just like Raw, they were taped 4 at a time, and this one was done the day after the Raw taping. And they had to scramble quite a bit because on International Incident, the original main event was Shawn Michaels and Ahmed Johnson teaming with the Ultimate Warrior, who flaked out for various things were happening, decided to no-show house show events, and then the WWF basically buried him to the live audience. But on this taping is the last Ultimate Warrior match in the WWF, not the last one that aired. That would be on the July 8th Raw against Owen Hart. This one, last match, was Ultimate Warrior pinned Vader with a shoulder tackle. I don't know if this is on tape somewhere, but I would be very interested in seeing that. So this is June 25th of 96, drawing 3523 to the center in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I'm sure that the venue has an actual full name. And this is, of course, because the pay-per-view is the next day on the 21st. This is the fourth of four Superstars taped on this show. So I don't know what order they might go in. But it is certainly an interesting show to me because of the people within, as I mentioned. I went chapter and verse with Austin. But this is the debut of the Goon, the guy known as Wild Bill Irwin at most other points in his career. And this Goon character, you might think, like, okay, Pete, we've listened to this podcast. You're clearly a big hockey fan. In fact, you're wearing your Boston Bruins hooded sweatshirt from the 2016 Winter Classic right now. And yes, I am. I thank you for guessing that because you probably, was it 2019 Winter Classic or whatever? But, are you offended that the Goon is this guy? Absolutely not. I love this character so much for a bunch of different reasons. And I actually have, like, superlatives for this guy when he comes out, because Bill Irwin is so good at doing that character. It's a shame that it was years after it could have ever worked, but hey, doing the wrestling in the hockey gear too is another thing that's just absolutely crazy. So somewhat eventful taping of WWF action in La Crosse, Wisconsin. It's just really insane to think like you're taping four Superstars at a time, and then in addition to that, there's about seven dark matches. I mean, my God, there's like I think 5 matches on this show. So that brings you to 27 dark matches. That's 27. I remember that Fort Wayne, Indiana taping in 91 had like 33 matches or 30 matches or something on it. Like, going to a TV taping like that where they're doing four shows in a row, it's just, I don't know if my brain could have handled it, especially in like 1991 when I was 12 years old. Like, do I really want to spoil all the television? It's like, do I really want to be in the studio audience at Mr. Belvedere and spoil the episode for myself for when it eventually airs? Well, I don't care. No, it would have been awesome to see Bob Uecker live, but hey, you know, I decided to bring in Mr. Belvedere, so that's probably a sign that I should start talking about the show. We got Hunter Hearst Helmsley, who is allegedly in the middle of his grand punishment period for the curtain call, taking on Mark Mero. Feels like a common matchup from this time period in the WWF. As I mentioned, we got Camp Cornette, Owen Hart, British Bulldog, and Vader in a six-man. It kind of established them for the pay-per-view the next day and all that was on the line in that one. Steve Austin, the Goon. So there's so much fun stuff here. So why don't I just get right to it? WWF Superstars, July 20th, 1996. I need to say a few words about this. It's probably the most podcast anybody will ever do on the 1996 Superstars theme. Like, I spent way too much time actually watching the different versions of it because, like, for King of the Ring, they had different lyrics. They incorporated Ultimate Warrior. But then there's about a 3 or 4 week period, including this show, where all those references sort of disappear. So everything from this taping, they kind of took out, and it might be because the generic version had references to the Ultimate Warrior, and you got to pull those given everything that's happened. Technically, they suspended him for a while until he could, quote, post an appearance bond, which obviously never ended up happening because this was basically bye-bye for Warrior in the WWF until 2014 in his Hall of Fame induction. So they change it every week, but they kind of just went right to the ring for this one. The first person we see is Hunter Hearst Helmsley. So for this 4 weeks, there's no theme song. So I was like, which one do I go on? So I went with the one that aired the following week, which incorporated Psycho Sid into it, which the return of Michael Hayes to singing. Of course, he's known as Doc Hendricks, but for whatever reason, I like the song. It's catchy, but I plots every time I hear his well at the beginning. I know he's not known as Freebird Michael Hayes at this point, but can we just consider this the long-awaited follow-up to I'm a Freebird and What's Your Excuse? It's just kind of funny as he's gotten older that Michael Hayes has evolved from a sort of wannabe rock star into a kind of going for the Hank Williams Jr. sort of thing. It sounds a little bit more country rock. I don't know. That's just the way it strikes me. So, as I said, Hunter Hearst Helmsley is in the ring. Very befitting of kind of the kind of jobbing that he was doing around this time, which I definitely have to get into because I've always wondered to myself, is that true? He's bowing in the ring. He's still got a woman with him at all times, which, given the losing streak that he was on, makes you wonder why those women were still actually hanging out with him. Like, oh, you're going to be running a wrestling company someday. I should stay with you. Apparently, they were all Southern Belles. And we see the three-man booth for Superstars. I don't know why that was necessary on this show for this point in time, but got to give Jim Ross something to do since he's under contract and he is there alongside Vince McMahon and Mr. Perfect. And they take predictions for this opening bout between Mark Mero and Hunter Hearst Helmsley. JR immediately picks Mark Mero in this one. But I'm very interested in Mr. Perfect's view of this because he would become intimately involved in an angle with these two guys in just a couple of months.
And you, Mr. Perfect. I'll tell you right now, Hunter Hearst Helmsley's on top of his game. Takes his time. I'm going Helmsley.
And later in the year, as we roll into October, Perfect is harassing Helmsley by stealing the women that would accompany Triple H to ringside. And then eventually he double-crosses Mero, who he had been mentoring, and Triple H ends up winning the Intercontinental Championship. It's an angle that kind of makes no sense to me as you get down to it. But somehow at the same time, it's expected that Perfect would turn on Mero the way that he did. It's really kind of a strange sort of thing. So Mark Mero, this all goes back to WrestleMania 12, where Mero is brought in and infamously called Mark Morrow Todd Pettengill in one of his absolute worst moments. Like, here's this guy that you've signed to this big contract. You're introducing him on the WrestleMania show, and you don't even get his friggin' name right. I mean, give me a break.
The Wild Man, Mark Morrow, ladies and gentlemen.
No.
Just truly an unfortunate beginning for Morrow's career in the WWF. Certainly star-crossed, and we meet Sable at WrestleMania 12 as she gets rescued from Triple H, so that's kind of how everything is sort of built up. And I just have one thing to say about Wild Man Mark Morrow. Why did Vince just not buy the freaking gimmick? You have these legal entanglements with WCW as it is. Everything can be bargained and traded. Just buy the damn gimmick, for God's sakes. I know you didn't invent it, but just swallow your pride this one time. Johnny B. Badd was one of Dusty Rhodes' greatest creations, but I'm sure that WCW would have been willing to trade out something in exchange. I mean, I'm sure that there were other legal things going on. Hell, the NWO thing is going on at this time. Throw that in the deal. Of course, you introduced him in February, in April at, you know, WrestleMania. Actually, it was March 31st. But, you know what I mean? For God's sakes, Johnny B. Badd, it's so wasted that, like, oh, God, why couldn't he have just been that? And I know that you can't just have him be the same character and call him something else, because that wouldn't have passed muster. Although, who knows? WCW might not have even acknowledged what was going on, because sometimes they didn't know their ass from their elbow. So Hunter Hearst Helmsley, and this is the topic that I really want to dive into here. May 19th, Madison Square Garden. You got all the members of the clique engaging in a group hug in the ring. Razor and Shawn and Hunter and Diesel. They all, this breach of kayfabe in the world's most famous arena, Madison Square Garden, even though it's 1996 and kayfabe is mostly a thing of the past. Razor and Diesel, they're going to WCW. They got other stuff going on. Shawn Michaels is the world champion. X-Pac, I can't remember, 123 Kid, I don't think he was there for that, maybe he was, but it doesn't matter because he's out the door soon anyway, so that leaves one person that you can punish for this sin of the wrestling business, and that's Hunter. So he loses out on winning the King of the Ring. He ends up winning the next year anyway, which may have actually been a blessing for him when you think about it, because I think he's better positioned in 1997 than he would have been in 1996 winning the King of the Ring, because he doesn't have China there until February of 97. And that's a huge thing to get him from ordinary mid-carder to mid-carder that people actually kind of sort of give a shit about. So how bad was his punishment, really? You look up his cage match record for 1996. It's 56 wins, 129 losses, and one draw. He's a bit of a workhorse that year for the WWF. But you'd think, okay, well, heels lose a lot of matches by DQ. They might not necessarily get pinned. So let's go through the timeline. As I said, May 19th is when this all starts. He actually beat Razor Ramon at MSG earlier that night. So fine, that makes sense, because Razor's going out. You want to put over somebody as he's going. At the infamous May in your house, beware of dog, he loses to Mark Morrow, the Wild Man. That is the show where the power went out. Then they had to redo it a couple of days later. At Raw the next night, so in between those two nights, we get the King of the Ring round one, where he loses to the aging Jake the Snake Roberts, this is during his vest-wearing period of the 1996 comeback. So, okay, losing to Jake in 1996, probably a bit of a punishment for him. He gets an enhancement win on the June 1st Superstars. So he's still beating enhancement talent when he appears on, like, Superstars. Losing to Morrow around the horn in June and July. I don't want to spoil this match for you, but that is the house show program that he's in. I'm not sure I consider that a punishment, because Morrow's the new guy in. You've got to establish him in some way. However, on the other hand, you could say, well, he's losing cleanly to him at every stop. There's no DQ losses or anything to that effect. Dark match at the King of the Ring. So he's not even on the pay-per-view where he would have become the winner of the tournament. And it's against Aldo Montoya, of all people. In Your House, International Incident, the July pay-per-view. He's completely left off it. No dark match, nothing. It's losing to Savio Vega on the September 8th Superstar. So now we're past the point where we are now. Loses to Sid in 3 minutes 39 seconds in the Intercontinental title tourney on the Raw Friday edition that they had in September. That owing to the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament, where Raw was moved to a different day of the week. That is actually on the network, even though it was moved to a different day. However, they do not have the similar Friday editions of Raw, which were called Friday Night's Main Event, that were done in 1997. That is a bit of a head-scratcher. I don't know why they can't just post those. And I know I've said I was going to do the September 5, 1997 Friday Night's Main Event at some point. And I will, because it's got one of my favorite things ever from Steve Austin on that show.
He's got such a come on down here because, like I said, Owen Hart's picture is right there on the old deer's ass, and that's where we're headed. Watch that step, it's a doozy, and if you fall, I'll beat that shit out of you.
Yes, I know this is the Hunter Hearst Helmsley segment and not the Austin segment, but there is a fun result for Helmsley in August on the 25th at the Nassau Coliseum. Savio Vega and Wild Man Mark Mero defeated Stone Cold Steve Austin and Hunter Hearst Helmsley. I'm pretty certain that old Trips took the pinfall in that one as part of this grand punishment. But yeah, the two-man power trip in 1996, losing to Savio Vega and Mark Mero. He loses to Jake Roberts again and Yokozuna on the South African tour in 1996. That's the same one that has a Bret Hart versus Steve Austin match that was in the Hitman Unreleased or something that the Dungeon Collection that they put on the network. I don't even know if it's still there. At In Your House Mind Games, Helmsley's in the dark match. He's losing to Jake Roberts in that one. 1996 Jake Roberts. I can't stress that enough. September 23rd, Raw. Helmsley loses to The Stalker. And that might be bottoming out there, you'd think, but on the October 14th Raw, he loses by countout to Freddie Joe Floyd, which, yeah, there were shenanigans that led to that actually happening. But the finale to all of this is, once again, Stone Cold Steve Austin in a very odd heel versus heel match. Helmsley lost to Stone Cold on the In Your House it's not Mind Games. The October one, I think it was Buried Alive. Whatever the October In Your House was, I don't care what it is. Weird heel versus heel match because Helmsley's filling in last second for Savio Vega because apparently there weren't enough Savio Vega versus Steve Austin matchups that year. And that's it. That is the extent of his punishment. He wins the IC title the very next night on Raw from Mark Mero in the aforementioned angle with Mr. Perfect involved. So my verdict on all of this, I feel like I've gone on for a while, this is like a full page of notes just detailing Triple H middle of 1996, is the punishment was really bad, but it didn't really hurt him too much in the end. And at the end of it, they needed heels by October, which is why, you know, you can just kind of snap your fingers and he's out of it. To my point about, He was much better off winning the King of the Ring in 97 than he would have in 96. I think he would have floundered in the middle of the year a little bit like Austin, and I don't think he would have come out of it because Austin was just by sheer force of personality. So in this case, the popular narrative about it is mostly right, although it's not it was not a punishment in the sense where it wasn't something he could get couldn't come back from. It didn't cause any lasting damage. It would take other stuff eventually, like China and like Mick Foley basically risking his body and putting it on the line in order to get Helmsley to the next level. So I'm assuming that this Mero Helmsley match is going to be a lot like their house show matches, as Helmsley, I'm noticing his gear at this point is really hilarious because he's wearing a belt. Like how many dudes were wearing belts with what appears to be wrestling tights? I think Skinner wore a belt too. I'm not sure that's the guy you should be emulating in even in 1996 WWF. Not entirely sure. As they talk about on commentary, Mr. Perfect was apparently on the Wrestle Vessel, which was a cruise ship that the WWF did around this time.
JR, have you noticed a little something about our compatriot over here? He's a little green around the gills, isn't he?
Yes, he certainly is. And a rather large splotch on your back there where you had that seasick patch the size of a pancake.
Oh, our back takedown nicely executed.
And we're talking about, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Perfect returning from the perfect vacation, if you would, the Russell Vessel. How was the Russell Vessel?
Oh, it was really great.
You got seasick, didn't you?
No, the fans made me sick. That's what made me sick. They wouldn't leave me alone.
Is that right?
There's nowhere to hide.
I heard you bonded with Luke and Butch.
Oh, so please.
It's going to be footage from the Russell Vessel a little bit later on in the show. I did not remember anything about this at all. And just looking into it, there's a woman who was on that and actually, I guess, won a contest to be on there. She said that the wrestlers kind of stuck to their families and they would pose for pictures and sign autographs for anybody, but people knew to keep a respectful distance when they're with their families. But how about that Vince laugh at the end? That might be the best mid-90s Vince laugh. I don't think it quite matches up to mid-80s Vince laughing at the hillbillies dancing. I think there's a little bit more oomph to his laugh in 85 versus 96 because everything was ascendant back then, and you know the mid-90s was kind of a tough time for the wrestling business. So yeah, there's an actual match going on here. Very slow start with a lot of arm work. And we see a shot of the lady who accompanied Hunter Hearst Helmsley to the ring. And Vince makes kind of an interesting suggestion that maybe the recent losing ways of Helmsley is because he's distracted by the women coming with him to ringside. I guess that's one way of putting it. Like, but yeah, it's a typical Vince thing to bury the woman rather than the guy who is actually in the match. They discuss the upcoming bout at In Your House, international incident between Mero and Austin. King of the Ring rematch for at the semifinals of that King of the Ring. Mero bloodied Austin's lip and he had to go get stitches for it at the hospital. And when he came back, that's where he found out that Jake had given a religious themed promo about old Stone Cold. So that gave him an idea for a promo of his own a little bit later that would sell a billion t-shirts. Mero kind of outquicking Triple H early in the match using his speed advantage as Marlena strolls down to ringside for some apparent reason with her cigar, which was totally a euphemism. You know, oh yes, we're going to have this woman and we're going to give her a giant cigar, and it's not because she likes tobacco. Okay, there's some sort of image that they're going for, and they go to commercial as Marlena makes her way down. Triple H misses an elbow as Marlena hands something to Sable. It's a gold box. Now, I could not remember what was going on here, but apparently they took an interest in Sable and were trying to get her away from Mero because they liked her for her looks. Anything in the box is going to be automatically over once she opens it up, but we're never actually going to see what that is, I don't think. So it is what it is. So Mark Mero, he's a little bit upset when he sees all this, but he has a crossbody for two and then a sunset flip coming back into the ring for two, follows with a clothesline. This is actually where he gets distracted by the box at ringside. But he does send Triple H to the outside, and he grabs the box away from Sable, Mero does, and just kind of throws it down. I'm thinking, is he going at, like, the, you know, sort of angry dude at his, you know, wife, girlfriend, however you want to put it? Is he doing this a year early? I think it's just he's the mind games of Goldust is what, this is his character's motivation. As Triple H, out of nowhere, with a forearm to the back of the head and a body slam out on the floor. Back inside, he goes up top and hits another forearm to the back of the neck. That gets a two count. You're going to be shocked when I tell you that Helmsley on offense is extremely deliberate. I hope you were sitting down for that. I mean, even in 1996, that was the case. Vertical suplex gets two. Got a trade of punches. And I don't think you want to trade with a guy who was a legitimate boxer before becoming a professional wrestler. Mero went over that in his podcast interview with Steve Austin several months ago. I think I referenced that one because it's like the one Steve Austin show that I've listened to in the last 18 months because I think it's like the one new show that he's actually done. But Triple H hits a tilt-a-whirl backbreaker. Apparently he's been watching those old Crush tapes to bring out that move. But then he gets caught coming off the top rope with a shot to the gut. As a tilt-a-whirl attempt by Helmsley is countered into a very, very crappy-looking head scissors by Mero. inverted atomic drop, a knee lift, a big back body drop. A very good Vince call on that one.
It may be the end, maybe near.
Here we go, coming off and a back body drop.
Well, the laugh might have lacked a little oomph in the 90s. The big back body drop, that actually picked up steam, the way Vince would call it. This goes a little back and forth as Triple H whipped into the corner. He actually does a flare flip. And actually, before that, Mero got a corner whip and ran into a boot. So it's going a little back and forth. Goes up top, Triple H does. He gets caught, and Mero scores with the Super Hurricane Rana, and very well done. And that is how he picks up the three count and the victory in this one. He doesn't debut the Shooting Star Splash until SummerSlam against Goldust, which Goldust actually kicks out of, which just seems absolutely insane. The problem is, and you know, I hesitate to be critical about Mero because it seems like everybody is, especially with his WWF time, but there isn't very much to that whole Wild Man character. Because it's really too bad, because we know from WCW that he's good. It's just that there's almost nothing to it. Like, what exactly makes him a wild man? I don't quite understand it.
You know, nobody puts the W in weird like Goldust or Marlena.
I'm not sure how that makes sense. Why would he put the W in weird? It doesn't really make any sense to me. It's not like he was winning a lot of big matches despite being the Intercontinental Champion earlier in the year. Even this match coming up with The Undertaker at the In Your House International Incident, it's a very strange one because Undertaker is feuding with Mankind and Goldust is kind of feuding with Mark Mero, but they're returning to this program that they had kind of dipped into, I think at the May In Your House. It's all a little bit strange to me, but I guess that's the whole vibe of Goldust at this time.
Dark is nothing to me. I'm always in the dark. A patch of blue, 1965. All hell will break loose, Undertaker. Like the devil's rain, I will pour upon you and bring you to your very knees. Like Freddy's claw, I will rake the very life out of you. I've put you in your casket before. But now you've dug your own grave. You will never rest in peace, Undertaker. And you will never forget the name of Goldust.
Cut.
I don't know, Marlena saying cut at the end kind of made me laugh, which salvaged the entire thing, because I was just bored for the 54 seconds that Goldust was talking. So Undertaker gets a rebuttal, and things are about to change for him, because this is the last pay-per-view where he and Paul Bearer are a unit throughout. It's at SummerSlam that Paul Bearer turns on the Undertaker and joins up with Mankind.
The hour is at hand! In your house, and Goldust, your name is on the marquee and lights, just where you want to be. But my Undertaker will turn your light off.
Goldust, unfortunately, you must come face to face with the most dangerous entity in the World Wrestling Federation. And I have chosen you as my messenger. For on your toe tag, the note will read, Mankind, run for your life.
I'm glad that Undertaker started speaking up and enunciating properly in his promos. I mean, after all, Paul Bearer is about to go away, so he's going to have to do a lot of talking on his own. But I was particularly tickled by how he called himself an entity. Like, is he calling himself that for tax purposes or something? I'm not sure what that's all about. Maybe I just have taxes on the mind because I started doing mine. And a friend of mine that I attend the Bruins games with was complaining because he actually got a 1099 tax bill because he resold too many tickets and went and made a profit of over $600, to which I explained, that's actually good. And then he realized that, oh, I probably shouldn't have made such a big profit on those Guns N' Roses tickets. But I guess this aside is just, you know, my quick advice to you. that if you're a season ticket holder for something, or if you're in the business of buying and selling tickets, spread it around a little bit. Do a little on Ticketmaster, a little on StubHub. You know, keep it away from the tax man. And speaking of hockey, this Superstars is a monumental occasion. I've covered debuts, huge angles, but I am just unreasonably excited to talk about the debut match of Wild Bill Irwin's new character, the Goon.
And next, hockey's loss is the WWF's gain as the Goon makes his WWF debut.
Have you ever been to elbowing before? What's the matter with you guys, huh? What, are they trying to ban me out of the...
Who was thrown out of every hockey league he ever participated in. He's too rough for hockey. He's here in the WWF. Let's take a look at the Goon. And here's the Goon in his hockey playing days. Not bad handling the puck, huh? Oh, come on, high sticking.
A little elbowing.
Look at that. Hey, slashing, give me a break.
He's a dirty player.
No doubt about that.
Now, I've covered some Wild Bill Irwin stuff on the show. I think he was on the World Class episode that I did, which is fitting enough given that he is the longest reigning cumulative World Class television champion ever. I believe he held that title on 7 different occasions. So this hockey player thing, you think, oh, well, Pete, why won't you be offended? It's making fun of your sport. Absolutely not, because hockey needs all the help it can get, particularly in the mid-90s when things got a little boring and scoring was down, although in 95-96 it actually ticked back up to levels that wouldn't be seen for another decade. But anyway, Bill Irwin doing this character, kicked out and banned from all hockey leagues, which is something that speaks to me personally, given that I probably am banned from leagues that I don't even know about. I mean, after all, I got thrown out of the last youth hockey game that I ever played for fighting. And not only is it on videotape, but the fight where I got thrown out, I skated over to the end boards, to where the locker room would be, and I turned around and my dad zoomed in ever so slightly with the camcorder, and I took off my glove and held up a middle finger to everybody in the arena, and that was the end of my youth hockey career. I was thrown out of the NHL breakout tournament in 1998 for throwing a ball at one of the officials, which, granted, might have been a little out of line, but there was a miscommunication about the rules, and I threw it at the guy left-handed. So it's not like I threw it at him with his strong hand. Now, this character, it's not evoking me or anything, although my last youth hockey game was in 1996. God, I should probably make a gif of that, me flipping off the crowd, because that was just priceless. What this does sound like is Happy Gilmore. The last Bruins home game that I was at on Tuesday night against Vancouver, a fella sitting in front of me was wearing a Boston Bruins Happy Gilmore shirt. Now, of course, Happy wore the Bruins jersey for much of the movie, but instead of a Bruins black and gold motif, what we're seeing from the Goon is kind of like a New Jersey Devils uniform jersey, but with no logos on it, which you can get at pretty much any sporting goods store. They sell, like, what are, like, hockey jerseys. Like, you could get, like, an Edmonton Oilers jersey, but it has none of the patches or logos or anything. So in a wrestling character, they like to draw on real-life experience. Now, how that's done, usually it'll be something like Steve Kern comes in. Oh, he likes wrestling gators, and that's how Skinner comes to be. And Steve Kern likes playing the character because, you know, he gets to be himself and turn it up to a kind of cartoonish degree, yes. Bill Irwin actually played high school hockey and apparently was a goon who would start fights with the best player on the other team. That was never my role in youth hockey, by the way. The only time I ever was, like, openly an agitator trying to get somebody thrown out of a game was playing soccer, and I actually successfully got the best player on the other team thrown out of the game. It was one of my finest accomplishments. So that him playing high school hockey and doing that goon role wouldn't have flown in the 1980s, but Bill Irwin, he would have been in high school in the early 70s, and like I always say, everybody was on drugs. Anything goes. So they probably were allowing that at that level. Now, a goon, for those of you who aren't familiar with hockey terminology, and there is a fine, fine movie starring, oddly enough, a guy I mentioned last week, Sean William Scott, called Goon. Came out, I believe, 2011, and it's very, very good. The concept is, it is a guy who's not a good skater, very low skilled, but is basically just a dirty player, like what Vince and the rest of them were trying to say as they were showing clips of Bill Irwin skating around on the ice. You could tell, I mean, he could skate a little. He's not a complete zero out there. The costuming on this character, I've always had high praise for the Big Boss Man character and the way they outfitted him. The boots that... The boots of the goon are the greatest boots in the history of professional wrestling. They are so friggin' awesome. And Bill Irwin actually explains how those boots ended up coming to be. Because, once again, it's another example of, well, you let the talent kind of, you know, obviously WWF has a whole costume department that would help along something like that. But Irwin, in an interview with ESPN about this character a couple of years ago, said, let's get a pair of skates, we'll take the blades off them, and we'll put the rubber soles on there and stack them high. Short people have been stacking them high for years. Yeah, like Bono. Do you ever wear platform shoes? Back in the 70s, I had a pair of orange suede platform shoes, and they were cool, man. When it came to making those skates, if you're going to make skates, you're going to have to have the look of standing on skates. And then Irwin goes on to talk about the character. I'll go to the ring with gloves, a stick, not a helmet, but the full garb. First thing I'll do is, in a hockey fight, I throw a bunch of punches. Boom, boom, boom. That's exactly what he does in this match. And to me, it's just so great. I love this so much. And I say that, and I don't know if I've ever brought this up on the podcast. In fact, this is one of those embarrassing things that, and it's wrestling related, that I should have brought up on an earlier podcast, but now that I have a little bit of an audience, I have to see if somebody else, you know, did this in the early 90s. I belong to something that came out of the wrestling magazines called the IWA, the Imaginary Wrestling Association, and you would submit, like, numbers that were codes for moves on a monthly basis. And I had, like, you know, a stable of wrestlers. And to bring it back to hockey, one of my characters was Mr. Hockey. And I don't know, all these years I've thought about it, like, was this like an e-fed where it was just me and they were getting my money and there was actually nobody else there and everything else was invented? Did anybody else actually do this? I really don't know. So, Back to goons in hockey. They're still around in 1996, but again, in the 70s, they were very much a thing. That's how you end up in a movie like Slapshot. Vince, he doesn't really have much of a clue when it comes to the sport, the finer points. He called an elbow a high stick, and he got the slash correct, but I'm going to buy Kurt Hennig's analysis on this much more because he's from Minnesota, and clearly he's probably a perfect hockey player as well. I do like they do compare him to a particular dirty player of the time.
The goon, ladies and gentlemen, Minnie State in hockey, makes Claude Lemieux look like a Sunday school teacher.
Claude Lemieux was a giant shithead, but he was on teams that won the Stanley Cup on four different occasions. Of course, he had to switch teams several times. He was Colorado, Montreal, New Jersey for a couple of those. He had actually been part of the previous two Stanley Cup champions as the show was taped in 95 and 96. He was not so much of a goon. He was more of what they call a rat, which is a more skilled player who does a lot of the dirty tricks that goons do. Now, they accuse Brad Marchand of doing that, but I don't think he's really been that since about 2018. Ever since that licking thing in the 2018 playoffs, he's been mostly on his good behavior. The number one rat in the NHL at that time was Ulf Samuelsson, and I will take no arguments on that one. I'm also looking at the goon's outfit, and it appears when he comes to the ring, he's got a wooden stick, which by 96, there were still few guys with wooden sticks, but now if you watch hockey, almost nobody has a wooden stick. Except, of course, for me, because I still have the ones from youth hockey. I have them in my garage and used them when I was playing hockey in my backyard last year, but also to push the insulation back up into the roof of the garage, because it's really, I haven't figured out a better way to do it. So he starts the match, dropping the gloves, running over against Dan Jesser, by the way, is the opponent. I do notice immediately that this jersey does not have a fight strap, and as he does not have one, he should be immediately ejected from the game. That is the rule in the National Hockey League. Pretty much any other league, like if you're in college, you will get ejected from the game for fighting. Of course, five for fighting. Not only the penalty in hockey, but also the name of a Canadian pop band from early in this century. You might remember a time in 1990 where a new character was debuting on Superstars by the name of Saba Simba, and this led to Roddy Piper going off on this sort of mini rant, like, no, that's Tony Atlas. What's with this Saba Simba stuff? It's Tony Atlas. And you think, wow, that's weird. Is that the only time that ever happened for a WWF debut? Well, it wasn't the only time.
That's why he's been kicked off of every amateur hockey team this guy's ever played for in the state of Minnesota. I have read about this guy. I know a lot about this guy. His name is Bill Irwin, and this guy likes to fight.
Indeed. That's pretty obvious here.
And I know what you're thinking. Of course Kurt Hennig knows all about Bill Irwin. After all, he rapped about him in the Wrestle Rock Rumble rap.
Kurt Hennig
and Big Scott Hall. Tag team champs, we'll take on them all.
So bring on the Long Riders, those dirtball dumbos.
We'll smear those bitches, do the Wrestle Rock Rumble.
No wonder why he eventually grew to hate rap. The jersey that the goon is wearing actually says goon on the back, which is very helpful, and also in line with an NHL directive in 1977 is when they required names to be on the backs of all jerseys. Some of the team owners at the time were not happy about that because they thought it would harm program sales, and the Toronto Maple Leafs' insane owner, Harold Ballard, or is it Howard Ballard? It doesn't matter. Anyway, he's a terrible person, and he had them wear blue, I think it was either blue letters on a blue jersey so that they couldn't be seen, and that was the way he tried to get around it, and the league did not frown upon that. Back elbow off an Irish whip, not exactly a hockey move there, or even a hockey fight move. In hockey fights, there's a certain, you know, code of honor where you're not supposed to use MMA tactics. I've always kind of waited for somebody to actually try and do that, but I'm always very interested in, like, how technical guys are in terms of fighting. Like, I'm not going to turn into, like, the Dave Meltzer of hockey fights, or like, well, I mean, if you don't appreciate what Sean Thornton does, I mean, what he did was on an art form. If you don't think he's the greatest of all time, then clearly you're just a big dum-dum. Like, I'm not going to say anything like that, but, you know, there are certain guys that I like more than others. As I get a headlock, but instead of doing like a classic headlock takeover, the goon just sort of tosses him down. That's something you might see more in a scrum near the net with the goalie covering it up or something. Get a hope spot with some gut shots and an arm wringer by Jesser. But the goon, he throws three right hands, which all miss, which is something that you'd see a lot in a hockey fight where just guys are throwing haymakers, more in the 80s than today. But then he gets taken down with a short arm scissors. I'm like, why is Dan Jesser getting in offense on him? Oh, yeah, that's right. This is the goon. They don't have any big plans. As Jim Ross says that the goons remind him of the Hanson brothers from the aforementioned movie Slapshot, which, if any wrestling characters that were created in the mid-90s are supposed to evoke the Hanson brothers, it would be the Dudley Boys, because that is exactly what they were going for with the glasses and the tape and just kind of the general craziness. It's not like they ever overtly, you know, went with that, I don't think. I mean, it's not like they would wear hockey jerseys to the ring. After all, that was kind of the public enemy thing going on. A lot of hockey puns by Vince and Mr. Perfect that don't really make a lot of sense. Don't forget, summer of 96 is when they created Jim Neidhart under a mask as Who, just so they could make Who's on First jokes. That was between Vince and Lawler. the referee is just getting in the way at a certain point here, and of course it's freaking Earl Hebner. It drives me absolutely insane that people think he was good, but when you look at him, everything that Earl Hebner did was like trying to call attention to himself. Hey man, you're the referee. You're part of this match here, but we should not be paying any attention to what you're doing. It's like being an official in a real sport. You should just sort of be, you know, in the background. Nice little move, the hip check type maneuver by the goon, and a back body drop, which it's effectively what that is. Like the Hanson brother hip check is almost like a low bridging a guy with a back body drop. He then charges Jesser and sort of knocks him to the outside, and then charges him again and boards him into the side of the apron, actually from behind. And he just rolls in and takes the count out win, because I don't know if he really has a finisher at this point. Not going to have it be like him just throwing a bunch of haymakers. They say, well, it's not like winning the Stanley Cup, says Vince and Mr. Perfect. But now that I think about it, they should have given him a fake Stanley Cup trophy to do. Like the inflatable one that I used to have that I think a hole got punctured in it and I don't think I can really fix it, but so what? They didn't have the inflatable Stanley Cups back then. Use a freaking spaghetti colander. Put some cylinders underneath it. Wrap it in foil. It's not too hard. And you can have the goon raise it up after every match. He would have been the most over babyface in the company and would have been taking the WWF title by Mania 13, I think. But probably not.
Savio Vega had just defeated Justin Hawk Bradshaw on Raw several weeks ago, and look what happens, that cowbell ringing in the ears of Savio Vega.
This is actually just a quick recap of events involving Savio Vega and Justin Hawk Bradshaw, who had come into the World Wrestling Federation earlier in 1996. You know, when I did that Mania episode for March, it was the Justin Hawk Bradshaw match against Hakushi, which I think was Hakushi's farewell match. He went back to Japan shortly after that. So that ended up taking place, Savio versus Bradshaw, on the free-for-all of the In Your House, which you can't see on the WWE Network, and I don't think that they've made it any sort of priority to add pre-show matches to from pay-per-views predating the network. It would be very interesting to see, because I remember on Royal Rumble Sunday, as I was watching the pre-show matches, this might have been the first pre-show that I had watched since I was down at Rosero's house. I saw a tweet from Wrestling Warzone podcast Chad Campbell. Of course, you might know him better from Where the Big Boys Play. And Chad suggested that Sheamus is the greatest pre-show wrestler of all time. Now, I don't know all the criteria that goes into it. I haven't seen enough pre-show matches. I certainly respect Chad's opinion enough that Sheamus would be in the running, and he would certainly know better than I. But we got to get all those pre-show matches on the network so that we could do a project, the greatest pre-show wrestler ever project. Not sure who exactly would come down with it, but I'm going to go ahead and say Coco Beware, because, you know, he wrestled dark matches before pay-per-views in the late 80s and early 90s, so he's always very good at firing up the crowd. So I'm quickly going to go on to this next segment, because I cannot believe that this is something that exists. It is a Bushwhackers match in the year of our Lord, 1996. But now that I think about it, they might have been on one of the earlier 1996 WWF shows that I did. They're facing Rod Bell and R.T. Williams in this one. So I'm like, how the hell were they using the Bushwhackers in 1996, as both guys are in either their late 40s or early 50s at this point? They used them on the European tour that they went on in the spring after WrestleMania, and on some of the early summer U.S. house shows. I don't think school was out at that point, but Bushwhackers are on a lot of those shows, such as that Curtain Call MSG show, where they defeated the New Rockers of Marty Jannetty and Leif Cassidy, a.k.a. Al Snow. And yes, indeed, the Bushwhackers were on the Wrestle Vessel. And this is where we see footage, because the Bushwhackers segment is not important. You see Perfect and Brett Mr. Perfect throws a ringer in horseshoes on the ship. He's shooting at clay pigeons as well. Yes, I'm sure it was a hell of a time. And one thing I was interested to find out about the Bushwhackers, because I didn't know anything about this. Apparently, at one time, they owned a restaurant in Tampa, Florida. It's long gone now. Apparently, it went out of business over 20 years ago. But it was at 4139 East Bush Road. I might be a Red Roof Inn. I think it was when I went to go look it up. There's probably a restaurant inside that. I don't know if the Bushwhackers one was in the hotel or whatever there, or if it was built anew afterwards. I mean, it doesn't really matter. Luke ends up in peril for a second, but Bell runs into, you know what? He runs into a boot. I could not give a shit less about what is going on in this battering ram as Brian Pillman shows up in the aisle for some reason, because we got to give him stuff to do. He was at the In Your House doing the online chat thing and made some suggestive comments about Sonny and the Bonnie Dottas and sexual intercourse during said pay-per-view. And he's on crutches because the car accident is not too far in the rearview mirror. And he's waving his arms in sort of Bushwhacker fashion, almost like he's Andre the Giant at SummerSlam 1991, which is very fitting because Andre was there with the Bushwhackers and was also walking around with the aid of crutches. So he kind of shakes hands with Butch and like, what is Pillman doing? Like, he's not, I don't know, he's not a baby face, so you wonder where this is going. And Butch just takes this as a sign of affection, so he licks Pillman's head. And just the way I would react, I would not like that, and neither did Brian Pillman. So he hits Butch with a crutch when he turns his back. So I'm just glad that there was a reason why Brian Pillman was on this show and that he had a reason to show up. It was just Brian Pillman being Brian Pillman in terms of... What I mean by that is... It is very loose cannon behavior to be friendly like that and then all of a sudden to flip out and hit somebody with crutches.
Guys, can we do this some other time?
No, we must evaluate the human species.
But I gotta get home to watch WWF.
WWF? This is extremely advanced entertainment. What do you call the subject?
She's a babe!
This specimen requires closer inspection.
Wow. WWF In Your House. It's out of this world, and it's only on pay-per-view.
That kind of reminded me of an old Victory Corner magazine promo that I covered at some point on this show. It obviously had to be late 1983 because that advertisement had Sergeant Slaughter on a TV, and he came up through the TV and invaded somebody's living room and basically pushed the guy around to make him feel like a big man. In this case, some adolescent teenage boy somehow transported Sonny into his living room, in his house, as it were. The thing, though, is when you bring Sonny in, farts on the couch not included. That is going to cost him a little bit extra. So for our next match, Stone Cold Steve Austin, who's coming to the ring in jeans. Wonder what the hell's going on here. If he forgot his gear again like he did at WrestleMania 15 when he had to wear a t-shirt instead of the vest. He is taking on Sonny Rogers. Or is he taking on Sonny Rogers? Because Austin at this point is kind of in a weird spot because he had won the King of the Ring at the pay-per-view the month before. He's, as we've established, he's facing Mero the next day on the In Your House. However, he's not really doing a whole heck of a lot because Mero's more feuding with Goldust now and like, well, we got to keep him busy somehow. And if you watch Raw in June and July, yeah, he's there. But the main character development of Stone Cold is taking place on Superstars, which is funny because when I wrote that article on my blog a long time ago and I've been searching for like the entire thing, and I can only find bits and pieces in my original notes, which really makes me sad because I put a lot of work into that. Austin was the last great character created using the Superstar show, which basically went away by the end of 1996. I think I may have talked about this in the October 96 Superstars, but it is a fun little thing where here's this guy who comes to define the Attitude Era alongside The Rock. But Austin, you know, became the big star first. And just like any guy from like the late 80s, he was made on Superstars using stuff like this, because here's his bit. He's got a normal enhancement match, just like anybody else. But Austin, he feels now that he's above that, and he would like some actual competition.
The World Wrestling Federation can keep signing Stone Cold Steve Austin to matches, and as long as they keep signing me to the likes of people like Sonny Rogers, I'm not going to wrestle, son. What the whole world is looking at is the King of the Ring. And if you think for one second that I'm going to wrestle the King of Losers, you got another thing coming.
That's not exactly the case.
Son, you ain't worth the sweat off of my...
Hey.
...brow. But I'm going to put you in the history books, kid. I'm going to forfeit the match tonight. Sonny Rogers... I'm not going to draw a breath of fresh air on you, son. Go ahead and raise his hand. Mr. Announcer, come on and announce the winner. Sonny Rogers just wins by forfeit.
That's unbelievable. It. How about that?
Raise his hand. He's the winner.
Sonny Rogers with a victory. By the father and from behind.
All right.
If you were to look up this Superstars on Cage Match, this match, quote-unquote, is not here. There's no reference to Austin versus Sonny Rogers. This is more of just an angle. And it's something that, if Raw had gone to 2 hours, let's say, at the same time as Nitro, this is something that probably would have been on hour one of Raw and would be remembered much more than it is. Because who the hell talks about Superstars, well, other than me, Superstars episodes from like 94 to 96 when Raw kind of had ascended to be the A show at that, that Raw's the A show and Superstars clearly now the B show. Stuff was still happening in 93 when they were trying to figure out what they had on that Monday night show on the USA Network. But yes, I won't wrestle this guy, and it's his recurring bit. But at least they're allowing him to show his personality, something that WCW was just loath to do for the entire time, with the exception of this little glimpse when he was in the Hollywood Blondes with Pillman, which was killed off very, very quickly. 96 Austin is one of the most fascinating characters ever. Like, what can we learn from this? What can we glean from this guy during his incubation period before he becomes the biggest star of the Attitude Era? I know you can debate him and The Rock, but I'm gonna put, because Austin became a star first. Like, I wish that I'd saved that freaking blog post. But what exactly can he just beat Sonny Rogers' ass, and there's no kick to the gut when he delivers the stunner. That does not come in until much later. And while he beats Mark Marrow at the In Your House International Incident, what does that get parlayed into? A pre-show victory in a minute 42 or something like that over Yokozuna at SummerSlam, because Yoko falls off the ropes. Basically the same finish as WrestleMania 10. It's a very slow build because Bret Hart had apparently expressed an interest in working with Steve Austin at some point down the road, and Bret was kind of taking offers from both sides and would eventually come back in the fall. The Marrow feud is a kind of a callback to the WCW days again, with Johnny B. Badd and stunning Steve Austin. It's not like they had an extended program on that side of the world, but it is an interesting match in that it's two new guys who you're trying to establish, and one of them is going to have to lose. And it ends up being the babyface in this babyface-dominated promotion. Back to the question that I posed. What can we learn from 1996 Stone Cold Steve Austin and the way he was kind of handled throughout that year? I suppose it's, if you know you have something and you can't do anything with it right now, just kind of keep it simmering for a bit. You know, just keep it at a very low temperature on the stove so that it's not going to overcook or overexpose in this case. And then eventually, when, I don't know, the right ingredients, like a Bret Hart, comes back in, you can add that into the mix and you'll have something much better, rather than burning through whatever you have as quickly as possible, which is a notable booking mistake across various territories over the years. But luckily, they took their time with Austin, and thank God Austin is King of the Ring in 96 instead of Helmsley, to go back to that point, because it allows for that slow build. If Austin's not King of the Ring, I don't know what happens. Does he actually get the kind of room to have these personality segments, including on the Raw right after this, after the International Incident pay-per-view on the 22nd? That would be the one live Raw at the four set of four Raw tapings. He was on commentary very early in the show. I cannot recommend the July 22nd Raw highly enough, where Austin ends up on commentary for one of the matches. I don't even know which one it is. And as he's sitting there with Vince, he makes a reference to the Lex Express and says something, "Oh, well, son, you used to put a guy on a bus, red, white, and blue bus, and ride around and kiss babies. Well, you should put me on a bus, and I could go around and whip at people's asses." Oh, it was such great stuff with Vince McMahon right there. But people don't tend to remember it. You just kind of pick up where Brett comes back and forget about this period between Austin 316 says, "I just whipped your ass," and the point where Brett shows up and Austin challenges him. That's about 3-4 months. And a lot of the stuff in between is gold. And that's why I do this show. So I can watch superstars from 1996 for no good reason that have these little gems, these Austin things.
Sable, I want you to take a good long look at Mark Merrill's face. Because after this Sunday at In Your House, I guarantee you, he won't look the same.
And this kind of thing, being on Superstars, allows Austin to truly find his voice where he's not exposed on Raw every single week. He comes off as a little bit of a serial killer in that one. I'm glad that they never went through with that thing where we're going to cross Austin and Sable, which supposedly was rumored at some point in 1998. Best to keep them in separate universes, because then you're able to get the benefits of each of them doing their own thing. As they go back to Doc Hendricks talking about the pay-per-view the next day, the Jim Cornette, Jose Lothario on the free-for-all, it's just going to be an interview segment, so clearly somebody's going to get beat up, Cornette's going to get thrown into a cake, you know, one of those deals. But we do have an interesting bout between two of the greatest talkers in the history of the business. It's Mankind, Mick Foley, taking on Jake the Snake Roberts. But, oh well, it didn't end up happening under mysterious reasons, which you could probably try and project what might have happened to Jake on that evening. It was actually on that same Raw after the pay-per-view where Jake called in on commentary, as they were fond of doing at the time, was having wrestlers call in to kind of do interview segments rather than having them actually join commentary, where he talked about the injury that took place. I don't remember the specifics, but Austin was on commentary at the time and made fun of him, along with Lawler. They were making light of his alcoholism, which is not exactly the greatest angle, either at the time or in retrospect. And Lawler and Roberts would end up facing off at SummerSlam. But the other thing is, with the International Incident pay-per-view, he's got to go through a border crossing, Jake. So it kind of makes me wonder what was going on, because he did wrestle on the last shows before the pay-per-view, which was in Maine about a week before. So who knows what happened in between. So the match becomes Mankind against Henry O. Godwin, because it's Hog. Get it? Yes. So at the very least, we do get a Jake promo. But something, you know, just like 1996 Jake Roberts is wearing, like, the fat guy vest. Something's a little lacking. Still good, though.
Oh, forgive me, Father, for what I'm thinking. You see, you've told me, Father, that you let the light shine, Jake. I'll take care of the rest. Lord, I've been trying to do the very best I can. Standing out and saying what I believe in. Trying to show somebody else the right way to live. Mankind, people like you are slow to learn. Oh, there's hope. There's hope for us all. The thing is, Mankind, how quickly will you learn? This Sunday, in your house, you get a quick lesson. It's a hard lesson. Lessons sometimes are a little too much to take. You taught me your lesson. Now you get mine in your house this Sunday.
inserting religion into pro wrestling is kind of a risky thing. We saw it with Ernest Angel in the Memphis episode from April of 88 that I covered a couple of months back now. And here with Jake, but one thing, just a quick aside, like I'm not a particularly huge religious guy by any means. I mean, after all, you know, my Jesus rose on the third day analogy earlier, somebody's probably pissed off at me for that one. At the very least, with this Jake run, we ended up getting Austin 316 out of it, and you know, eventually propels him into the stratosphere. But what I don't like is anti-religious people say, you know, castigating, oh, well, why do you believe in fairy tales or any of this business? Hey, with Jake, it's kind of a situation where if somebody has problems in their life, and religion can be a structure to kind of lead them back onto a good path. So, I mean, that's religion being used for good. There's often so much of a focus of, oh, well, you're using, you know, your religion for, you know, evil purposes or whatever, crusades, what have you, all throughout history. I don't know how the hell I get onto that. But yes, Jake was very religious at this point, and not quite so dark like he was in 91 and 92. So Mankind gets his rebuttal. Yeah, he's hanging out in boiler rooms, which probably getting the lay of the land for the boiler room brawl against Undertaker. They would set that up on the In Your House by actually... Mankind would come up from under the ring, attack the Undertaker during his match against Goldust, and they would fight to the back and into the boiler room. And Gorilla Monsoon would make a boiler room brawl match for SummerSlam on the spot because he was a respondent president of the World Wrestling Federation.
What was it, Jake the Snake? What was it that led to your wicked ways? The money? The fame? What I don't understand is, if you could not cope with success and in your house, how will you deal with the most crushing defeat of your career? You say you're born again, but I say you've left a trail of sin behind you that he may forgive you for, but that I cannot. The time is upon us, Jake the Snake. It's judgment day. And for ruining the lives of innocent people, I find you guilty. And in your house, we're gonna have to pay the price. Have a nice day.
Do the words "out to lunch" mean anything to you?
Thanks, Doc. Anyway, Mankind's rise through 1996 always seems to get a little bit more ink than Austin because he was on Raw more of the time, much higher profile feud with The Undertaker. And oh yeah, he just happens to be the greatest opponent that The Undertaker ever had, at least in the 1990s, and I would extend that through The Undertaker's entire career, because there's too much bullshittery with the Brock Lesnar matches, and especially the Shawn Michaels matches, which, I'm sorry, I don't really feel like talking about that. And besides, me discussing wrestling from 2009 and 2010, it's not really good for the podcast.
Universal Pay-Per-View Entertainment Sudden Death, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme, presents the Sudden Death Slam of the Week. Against all odds, Michaels still the World Wrestling Federation champion.
It's not a surprise that it's a sponsored segment looking back at the previous Monday's Raw. The sponsor itself is a little bit surprising to me for the movie Sudden Death, which I guess they were airing on a pay-per-view basis at that time, still doing that in the mid-90s, where movies would go from the theater to pay-per-view and then eventually onto VHS. And, I don't know, since there's been enough hockey on this show, I mean, what's one more thing? I mean, Sudden Death, there's a big hockey scene in the movie. It features one of my all-time favorite trivia things for any movie ever, particularly for a sports movie. If you recall, the Pittsburgh Penguins, because it's set in the igloo in Pittsburgh, are playing the Chicago Blackhawks. There are actual NHL players out there, But some of them, well, they were not happy about the way that they were portrayed, even though they weren't in the film, such as number 68 for the Pittsburgh Penguins at that time, Jaromir Jagr. Is the IMDb trivia for this, and I read a whole article on this a couple of years ago, so it is true. Jaromir Jagr wasn't happy that the hockey player wearing his number 68 was on the ice for three of the opposing team's goals, making him a -3. Being that concerned about stats in a movie that you're not even in is just very much on brand for the mercurial Jaromir Jagr of the 1990s. So your main event for the previous Monday's Raw was Shawn Michaels defending against future DX member, although not at the same time, Billy Gunn. The thing they were going for on that show is Ahmed Johnson defended against Bart Gunn. So you had the tag team champions. Each of them were challenging for the two singles titles. And then the following week, Ahmed and Shawn would challenge for the tag team titles themselves. This alliance between Shawn and Ahmed is so fascinating to me. And it's not a white-black thing. It's just that they're so different in other ways, such as Shawn is kind of a male stripper type, and Ahmed is the guy who completely flips out because Goldust gave him mouth to mouth at one point. Like, what do these two guys talk about, like, when they're alone in the locker room? It's probably how best to lose singles titles not in the ring, because both of those guys are experts at that.
Myself and Ahmed Johnson, I know everybody thinks we're the psychos. Can we trust Psycho Sid? I believe we can. There's a relationship between the Heartbreak Kid and Psycho Sid that a lot of people do not know about and I can't get into right now. We'll go into it at a later time. I think Sid is going to be there by our side. Ahmed Johnson, the Heartbreak Kid, and Psycho Sid are going to take care of Camp Cornette. What's a brawl? We're talking about a gang warfare. It's going to happen. I'm not thrilled about it, but one way or another, it's going to happen. Camp Cornette, don't bring a knife to a gunfight.
Hey, I've picked on Shawn Michaels for many things over these 3 years of doing Greetings from Allentown, but I actually kind of like that promo because he took great pains to explain, oh yeah, me and Sid were okay, but I really don't want to get into that. I'm not sure if he ever did fully explain it. I mean, there's only so much WWF TV I can watch. There's only so many hours in the day. It's just Ahmed and Shawn with Psycho Sid calling themselves the People's Posse, which, to bring it back to the imaginary wrestling association, that E-Fed that I was referring to earlier, what did I call my stable of wrestlers? Of course I called them the Posse. So it ties back. Please tell me somebody else took part in that who is a listener to this program. Please. Because for the last 30 years, I thought I was just sending in money to some guy who was making me think that it was a community thing. So the highlights from Raw, we see Jim Cornette's guys appear to leave during Shawn Michaels' match, but it's a big fake-out just to make you think that they're gone and that they're not going to attack or ambush. And when Shawn comes back through the curtain, the great duo of Ahmed and Shawn, Ahmed is congratulating him as Jim Cornette comes over and throws coffee. I don't know if he threw it at Ahmed or at Shawn. It really doesn't matter. Wrestling has this noble tradition of managers or authority figures, as it were, throwing coffee at wrestlers. Usually wrestlers that are non-white. So I guess maybe he did throw it at Ahmed. Who knows? So they run after Cornette, who knows that his three guys, Vader, Owen Hart, and the British Bulldog, are waiting and setting them up for an ambush. Now, you're like, okay, well, it's a 3-on-2. What's going to happen here? Well, Sid, Psycho Sid, they call him that not just because, you know, his behavior is a little bit erratic, and that's been well established over the years, you know, flaking out on indie shows and all the various things, but also his driving style as well. Sid was, years ago, I want to say it was 2011, Sid got pulled over in the Memphis area, I don't know if it was in Tennessee or in Arkansas, where he got pulled over for not wearing a seatbelt, which in some states it's a secondary offense, some states it's a primary, so I guess it was in the primary state because you can pull him over for that. And Sid just happened to have weed on the armrest. I don't know what came of that case, but this is just the most Sid way to get arrested. But He's got his car in 96 here, which, by the way, he'd be in a very bad car accident the next year that would kind of derail that run for him post-WrestleMania 13. And we got Suddenly Sid, which, by the way, that would actually be a pretty good TV show. Maybe have it be like the companion piece, Suddenly Susan. You could do crossover episodes where Sid goes out on a date with Brooke Shields. I feel like that would have had a lot of potential. Now, of course, you'd have to schedule shooting around softball season, but, you know, you could probably play softball on the lot. I mean, I think Sid would definitely take to that. And Sid, he doesn't pull up his car like a normal person and then get out and run after them. He crashes it into, like, this dumpster cart, like one of those plastic rolly dumpster carts. He's going, like, as fast as he can, he just smashes into it, slams on the brakes. He gets out of the car and proceeds to run the long way around, chasing after Cornette's guys who have just gotten into a car and taken off.
Wow, and then Psycho Sid pulls up in his car. He could have killed somebody. Sid, Shawn Michaels and Ahmed chasing Kemp Cornette.
So if you're thinking there's something very, very strange about this segment, yes, indeed, you would be correct, because the four Raws are all taped the day after the King of the Ring, which is fine. It's the way they're doing things. However, when you have the Ultimate Warrior flaking out and no-showing everything, and he's supposed to be in the main event teaming with Shawn and Ahmed, what exactly do you do when you have everything in the can? Well, you carefully edit him out the best you can. He has his final match against Owen on the July 8th Raw, and you got to insert Sid somewhere, which happens to be on that July 8th Raw, where he's introduced in an interview segment, and he shows up with this car on the 15th, where it's taped later on in order to fill in the footage and establish him in some way rather than just standing there looking menacingly in an interview. So a real pain in the ass for them to have to edit out the Warrior and then have to reshoot stuff because you've got a completely different guy in the main event and you want to work him into the mix. But Jim Cornette's six-man team of Bulldog, Owen, and Vader, they're coming down to their match is actually up next, accompanied by, of course, Jim Cornette, but also Diana Hart Smith is there, and I just wrote WTF next to her name. I'm like, she's still around? I mean, like, what a basket of charisma this woman was, just all around. And Owen Hart, at this point, in 96, he was doing a lot of commentary. In fact, in that aforementioned South Africa series or match with Brett versus Steve Austin, Owen is actually the color guy on that one. He's wearing a Bob Orton cast because he had some sort of wrist or forearm injury, but he kept kind of working through it. So nice little heel move to have the cast on there. I always appreciated the Bob Orton thing and him wearing it for as long as he did, and it's something that certainly has worked in wrestling all through the years. So their match comes up after the break, but there's a plug for the superstar line of the WWF superstar line. And it's really odd because I swear this music that they're playing underneath it is very familiar.
The World Wrestling Federation superstar line never closes. Just call 1-900-737-4WWF. And right now in option 6, who's in and who's out of this Sunday's international incident? Plus, get predictions and all the late-breaking news. It's just $1.49 per minute. Kids under 18 must have parents' permission before calling. Call now.
Going nuts because it sounds so familiar, and then I realized, oh yeah, it was one of Lex Luger's themes from WCW. What an odd thing. Just seems so weird. Like, why is Lex Luger's WCW music plugging the WWF hotline in the year 1996, less than a year after Luger skipped town on them? I don't get it. Like, the particularly stupid children in the audience probably think, oh, does this mean Lex Luger is coming back? I guess it wouldn't be that stupid if they could put two and two together. Like, wait a minute, that's Lex Luger's theme from WCW, and why are they playing it on here? The answer is, it's probably just some production music. It's labeled Slammer as the name of it on YouTube. But nobody has claimed ownership of it, though, so it's not being monetized by any particular artist. And I know that that does happen with production music. It goes into a commercial on the video for this, and it's a one of those Time Life sort of dealies, a Southern Comfort LP, a sort of best of compilation. You can get two cassettes for $19.95. You can tell it's definitely within a certain period of time if they're plugging cassettes. I mean, in the year 1996, though, that is awfully late, although my car had a cassette player at that time, and I was, you know, gratified just to have that. Two CDs is $24.95, which sounds like a much better deal to me. As we do go in to our final bout, Owen Hart, British Bulldog, and Vader, and they cut off the jobber intros. We don't find out who these guys are, but it's Bill Payne, Rex Royal, and Kevin Kruger. It's kind of strange that there's a guy named Bill Payne, because it's the same name as the guy who was the CEO of the Atlanta Olympic Games, which is going to be getting underway, actually, probably on that weekend in 1996, as I recall. Owen starts out with Payne, and Payne puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a three-year ring veteran, which is what Payne is at this point, hits a clothesline over the top on Payne and tags in the British Bulldog. They hit a double clothesline. Of course, they would go on to success later in the year as the tag team champions, and then into 97. Bulldog and Owen were a very good team. And adding Vader into the mix just kind of makes them a little bit cooler. Like, really a true threat for a six-man team. You know, every so often, you know, they come along. Everybody loved the Shield. The Wyatts were so good as a three-man unit for a while there, it made me forget the fact that Bray Wyatt absolutely sucks. I mean, that's how good they were for a period of time. As we get a reversal of a corner whip, but Bulldog comes charging out of the corner, hits a clothesline, I think it was. I think my notes really kind of, I was getting annoyed at the dealership, so my notes started petering out at this point, as Rex Royal is in there, and he's going to take the delayed vertical patented British Bulldog suplex. Now, Kevin Kruger gets a tag, so that means Vader is going to come into the match, and he hits some headbutts, about four in a row, and then a short arm clothesline. So Vader stealing one of the Jake the Snake moves. I guess they had a heart-to-heart at King of the Ring 96 when Jake beat Vader by DQ, which is how Jake ended up in the finals, in case you had forgotten. Then Vader just kind of runs over him, as we're reminded by commentary that Vader is the person who handed Ahmed Johnson his first loss in the WWF. That's a maybe something to file away if I ever have to write trivia questions for a Place to Be Nation thing at some point in the future. But we're going to take time out during this six-man bout, because, you know, each guy's got to get his shine in. It's going to take a little bit of time before we get to the finish. It's time to bury the Ultimate Warrior.
This all started, by the way, of course, with the suspension of the Ultimate Warrior, indefinitely suspended for failing to appear at a number of WWF venues. No one WWF superstar certainly above answering to our loyal World Wrestling Federation fans. And to that end, WWF officials are still maintaining dialogue with the Warrior's attorneys in an attempt to work all this out. And who knows, the Warrior may be back in action.
Yeah, I guess it would be about 18 years before they would finally work that thing out. But yeah, they were still keeping the light on for the Warrior, even though he completely screwed them up for a pay-per-view main event, forcing them into reshoots and all that. It's very interesting to hear that, because you just think that they went straight into killing him off television. Well, they gave him a little bit of time, and then when they realized that nothing was going to come of it, then, well, let the full-on burial begin. Vertical suplex by Vader, and he pulls up the poor guy at a two count, could have gotten the victory, and hits those Vader short jab punches in the corner, you know, just beating the hell out of the poor guy. Tags in the British Bulldog, who then immediately tags in Owen without doing anything. It's like, did Vader forget, like, the order of things? It doesn't really matter. I'm not going to throw a temper tantrum at Vader for forgetting stuff like Shawn Michaels did. Completely unprofessional. I mean, if I was Vader, I would have just shot on Shawn Michaels. And, yeah, well, then again, I've already established myself as just being very petty and unprofessional. a standing drop kick by Owen Hart, who then tags out to the British Bulldog. So this tells me that maybe things were in the wrong order. Bulldog hits the patented running power slam, and that is what picks up the three count. Yeah, I love these guys as a six-man unit. I don't know if you could do like a formal ranking of six-man teams. I guess you could do it across wrestling history. But maybe I would end up overrating these guys because, as we've established here on this show, I have this soft spot for summer 1996 WWF. They go into a music video for The Undertaker, which is mostly just his theme with him saying platitudes that are not unlike Ultimate Warrior promos. The difference to me is that Undertaker is kind of kept separate as his own thing, and also his character is different enough where he's not being portrayed as human. Like, the Warrior was still a human being who was acting decidedly non-human. Undertaker is this undead zombie. And for whatever reason, I was always willing to accept that. And he's using, like, fancy words, like entity, in referring to himself. As Mankind's kind of cuts in as they, not physically, but they kind of... When they go to the footage of Mankind, it stops and the song takes on a different tone. Then they show highlights of like the last 3 years of The Undertaker, basically his entire babyface run, showing stuff of him killing Jimmy Snuka. Probably isn't going to do anything for anybody other than the Argentino family. Then we see Gold Dust footage of him because he's still nominally feuding with him, facing him the next day at the pay-per-view. I mean, it's perfectly fine and all, but... Again, I'm a very petty man, so what I would have done here was I would have just put together 4 minutes of footage of just Undertaker killing Diesel, just beating up Kevin Nash, because that's what Bill Watts would do. That's what Ole Anderson would do. The true, like, ornery a-holes of the business would be like, oh yeah, Kevin Nash, you want to go over there and form the NWO? You want a war, as your medium-sized Meng would say? We're just going to show you, we're going to run a video of you getting beat up by The Undertaker for no real reason. It's what Bill Watts would have done. Of course, Watts is long gone. He was only there for a few weeks in late 95. But that video, that puts a wrap on this edition of WWF Superstars from July 20th, 1996. On the Pro Wrestling Only feed in the past week, we got a new Days of Thunder looking at the Great American Bash 1998, a kind of forgotten pay-per-view that I really only remember as the thing between the Slamboree show that I went to and the Bash at the Beach, which they valued much more. It's kind of funny how the Great American Bash in the 80s was, you know, one of the main shows, and then when it became one of 12, it was just mostly forgotten. You also got the Bigfoot Pro Wrestling podcast looking at independent professional wrestling from the Pacific Northwest, and the return of the Pro Wrestling Super Show looking at gimmick matches, all the various kinds that you can find and enjoy. Now, on the Our Vantage Point podcast, episode 163 with Joe Marotta and Michael Quinn, look at the influence of WCW Monday Nitro on professional wrestling as a whole. And on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett, Brian Fury is down in Florida, but he's probably going to be back for this Friday's show in his promotion, Chaotic Wrestling, out at the Hudson Elks, where I'm happy to say that I will be there with Keithy. You probably won't be able to miss us. You can probably hear us from anywhere in there. And Brian Malonis joins Mike. Actually, Brian, of course, one half of the Bouncers, or maybe I should call them the Bouncers, because they were seen on NWA Power. So I think when introducing Malonis from now on, Crockett should play this.
Sanctioned by the NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance.
I don't think I can get enough of that song. I also like the voiceover guy, sanctioned by the NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance. Like, yeah, thank you. I thought it was the rap group who was actually sanctioning wrestling. They're talking wrestling magazines on their show this week. And also, I know we've had some false starts on this, Steve Bennett and I, but we have an Adams Division podcast in the works. It is WrestleMania related. It's a very fun concept that we've come up with. So be on the lookout for that. That'll be on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed when it does come out. I'm very excited about this chaotic wrestling show out in Hudson this Friday. Number one, because apparently we're not getting a snowstorm that day, so it'll be easy enough to get there. But I'm so excited about the appearance of Brian Pillman Jr. to the point where I am actually going to get my mark pick taken in the ring, and I'm going to insist that Keithy take the picture of me and Pillman, and then he can go off and ask them about their farts and their fantasy teams and whatever it is that Keithy does at these events that I don't attend with him. But that I love the chaotic shows. It's funny how I always seem to make it to the chaotic shows in February every year. I think there's actually another one 2 weeks later as they are on the road to Cold Fury, the biggest show of the year. Actually, yeah, that is the biggest show of the year in chaotic canon, as I recall. No YouTube comment theater this week because the video is not on YouTube. This might be so meaningless. I'm not even sure, like, Monsoon Classic has matches from this show on there. I mean, it's Superstars from 1996, but I love it so much. Also, no Vinny Vegas Corner, mercifully, as I went 1-10 for the NFL postseason. Maybe I should just do hockey over-unders in order to... See, you know what, just NBA games, just bet the overs, because guys just shoot threes now, and it almost feels like every game goes over. I should probably look and see what the numbers on that are. I don't know what show I'm going to be doing for next week. It's going to be one of those things, ever since the YouTube purge, it's going to be something that strikes my fancy, something that's probably been in the queue for a while. I've promised shows to a number of people. I know Keithy asked me to do a certain show several months ago, probably like 6 months ago now, but it was WCW 1992, and I just did one of those. I don't know, maybe I'll consult with him on Friday and see what he thinks of things. But while you wait for next week's show, or listen to the other great podcast that I plugged a few minutes ago, why don't you leave a 5-star review for Greetings from Allentown on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you can leave fine podcast reviews, because it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this podcast. I'm sorry for my laughing. I guess I'm just having a good old time this week. WWF 1996, especially in the summertime, it just puts me in a good mood, good frame of mind. So that is it for me this week. But thank you so much for listening, and tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
It's a victory for the Goon here in his first appearance in the World Wrestling Federation. He shoots, he scores!